weekend. I want to welcome all of our guests and first-time visitors at all of our campuses. We are absolutely thrilled to have you with us. And one of the things I want to do right out of the gates is I just want to thank everyone who serves. They go above and beyond at all of our campuses to make this just what it is. And I'm reminded of this because this weekend, we had CIY Superstart here, which is a ministry to middle schoolers, and we hosted nearly 2,500 middle schoolers here in this room at Northwest. So if you smell something in the air, it might be the wonderful body odor of our middle schoolers. You might be able to smell it through the camera, other campuses, all right? But man, we had just a killer team of volunteers, and it just reminds me that I just don't say thank you enough. So I'm talking like kids ministry volunteers, guest services, those of you who stand out in the parking lot and point us to where we should park safely, those of you that serve behind the scenes, keep our facilities clean and safe. Man, at all of our campuses, can we just thank everybody who goes above and beyond? Thank you for serving. I know how it goes, man. You volunteer for something, and at first you're excited, then after a few weeks, you go, man, does anybody even notice? And man, we do. And I just want you to know that regardless of how you serve, you are making more of a difference around here than what you may realize. So thank you so much. I want to encourage you at each of our campuses this Thursday night, March the 8th, from 7 to 8, we're having nights of prayer and worship at all of our campuses. We're very, very excited about this. Want to encourage you to come this Thursday night to your campus where we'll just spend an hour together lifting up our voices, praying, and encouraging one another. If you have a Bible or a Bible app, would you please meet me in James chapter 3? It's in the New Testament. James chapter 3 is the passage that we're going to be walking through today. I have a good friend of mine who lives in Kentucky, and he was telling me that not long ago he took his wife out on a date. And so they are spending a very romantic evening at Lowe's. Because many of you know, the longer you're married, the more, you know, kids you have, all that, your dates and your errands sort of like run together, all right? So they are in Lowe's, they're in the checkout line getting ready to check out. When he has three teenage daughters, so you can be praying for him. One of his teenage daughters calls him on his cell phone, which immediately he knew something was wrong because she never uses the phone to call. It's all texting, right? So he answers the phone and he goes, "What's wrong?" She says, "Dad, the dumpster's on fire." Apparently, he had rented a dumpster that weekend to do some cleaning out of the garage. It was kind of sitting in the driveway, and she says, "It's on fire." And he goes, "Well, is it outside the dumpster?" And she's like, "No, it's inside the dumpster." So he thought, "Well, I think we're okay." He thought it was just a little brush fire or a little few little flames. He says, "We're on our way home. Just keep an eye on it. You know, if it gets outside the dumpster, call the fire department." So they get done. They're in the car. They're on their way home when his teenage daughter texted him this picture of the dumpster. So a little bigger than he thought. He said that they're still miles from home and they can see the smoke billowing in the distance. And so they're racing to get home. And he said by the time they got home, the fire had burned itself out, meaning everything in the dumpster was literally burned up. And so the fire just had nothing else to burn. And so they're just thinking that they dodged a bullet, like he was just glad everybody was safe. And so after he checked all that out, he began his investigation. His investigation really centered around this question, like what started the fire, right? And so he wanted to know. And so he's beginning to interview each of his kids and asking them what they knew and what they were doing. And finally, his very responsible 18-year-old daughter steps forward and she confesses that it might have been her. And she says, you know, she explains the situation that she had her boyfriend over. It always involves the boyfriend, all right? So they're over that afternoon, and they were, I know this is going to be shocking to some of you, they were shooting exploding targets with rifles, all right? Did I mention they're from Kentucky? All right, so that just explains it. Sounds like a good time to me. But anyway, she said that one of the embers from the exploding targets just maybe might have fallen into the dumpster. They didn't think anything of it. They didn't see any smoke, but apparently it just kind of sat in there and smoldered until it burst into flames. By the time it did, they were already gone. And she didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't intentional, but does it really matter? I mean, it started with a small spark that ended up bursting into this enormous flame. Unfortunately, we're seeing more and more that this is oftentimes just to be expected. The wildfires that take place every year, the most recent ones were in Santa Barbara, and these fires cost millions and millions of dollars of damage. They take the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And when these fires finally are managed to be maintained, or when they finally are able to get them out, the authorities will do the same thing that my friend did. They'll begin an investigation where they want to trace, okay, where did this fire start and how did it start? And 90% of the time, these fires are caused by human beings. Somebody who they didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't arson. It just happened unintentionally, but does it really matter? I mean, it was just maybe a campfire that wasn't put out appropriately. Maybe it was a cigarette butt that got flicked out of the window. And this small spark causes this huge flame. Now, this image of a spark causing a flame is actually the word picture that our guy James is going to use here in James chapter 3 to describe the power that our words can have. Now, we all know, metaphorically speaking, when it comes to our relationships, that a fire can break out. Metaphorically speaking, and it can actually burn that relationship to the ground. So maybe you had a friendship at one time in your past that burned to the ground. And you were really, really close with this other person. I mean, maybe you were BFFs, you rode a tandem bike together, you know, you had matching outfits. I mean, you were going to be friends for life, but maybe you realize, man, it's been several years. I haven't even talked to this other person. And as you stand there kind of in the ashes of that relationship and you do an investigation of your own, you find out that there were some words, some sparks. Didn't seem to be all that big of a deal at the time. You didn't do it intentionally. It wasn't on purpose. But it caused this fire that burned the relationship to the ground. Maybe it was your marriage. And maybe there was a time in your life when you and your spouse, you loved each other, you were on the same page, you had plans and dreams and hopes for your future, but maybe you got careless with your words and there were some sparks. You didn't necessarily mean for it to cause the kind of damage that it did, but by the time you recognized that there was a fire in the relationship, it was maybe even too late to get it put out. And maybe it was your career, maybe it was your reputation, your influence that got burned to the ground. And as you stand there and as you ask the question, all right, man, what in the world happened here? I didn't intend for this to go this way. Well, James has some answers for us. James was the half-brother of Jesus. He was also one of the leaders in the Jerusalem church. And because of that, because of his connection to Jesus and because of his position in the early church, when James spoke, people listened. James' words carried a lot of weight. And so he writes one of the most practical books in the New Testament. In fact, if you're looking for just some really practical teaching, James is your book. And he writes this letter not just for his church in Jerusalem, but it's also going to get passed around to the other churches in the area. In fact, James is one of the earliest letters that we have in the New Testament. And the tongue must have been a real problem for people in these churches. Aren't you glad times have changed? And James devotes more time and attention to the issue of the tongue than Peter and Paul ever do. Peter and Paul wrote much of the New Testament as well, but James really zeroes in on this issue, as we'll see today. And as we read through this, there's two things that become extremely clear. The first thing is that our tongues are a real problem as it relates, I think we all realize this, to our relationships. That's what we've been talking about all series long. But James is going to even say, hey man, our tongues, the way that we talk with each other within the church, like as Christ followers, this can actually hinder or block the very mission that Jesus has given us. The mission of the church is to get as many people to Jesus as we possibly can. James is going to say, man, if we don't watch our speech within the church, then it'll actually hinder that. The second thing that becomes clear is that James is going to include himself in the battle. James is going to say, hey, listen, in case you thought that I've mastered my tongue, I haven't. I'm right there with you. He uses the word we. He says, man, I'm at the front of the line. God is continuing to work with me on this issue because I realize how easy it is for me to have a slip of the tongue. It's actually what he begins with right out of the gates in verses 1 through 2 of chapter 3. Look at this with me. He says, dear brothers and sisters. So notice the kind of the compassion in his words here. He says, dear, and then he's referring to them as brothers and sisters because we're a family. And he's going to say some hard things. But he says, not many of you should become teachers in the church. For there's the word, we. For we who teach will be judged more strictly. Indeed, we all make many mistakes. Now keep this in mind, because James is going to say some tough stuff here in a few verses. But he says right out of the gates, hey, listen, we all make mistakes. We're all human beings. We're all going to mess up. And then he says, I'm at the front of the line here. And as a teacher and a preacher, God is going to judge me more strictly. In other words, James realizes, man, my words carry a lot of weight with them, and I'm leveraging my influence here to speak, and so I realize this, and so God's going to hold me accountable to this. And man, can I tell you, as a teacher and a preacher, when I read this, this is humbling. Just to recognize that I'm going to be held to a higher standard, not just for what I do, but for what I say on a weekly basis. And every now and then I'll have somebody come up to me. Sometimes it's a younger person. Maybe they're thinking about going into ministry. Maybe they feel like God's calling them to that. Or maybe it's just somebody who's curious. And they'll say, "Hey, Aaron, what's it like? What's it like to like stand up on a stage and just communicate to thousands of people every single week?" And the way that they ask the question leads me to believe that they think that it's like a real perk, like that it's real. Now don't get me wrong. It is a privilege. It's a blessing. I don't take it lightly. I've said this before, that I believe that God has given me the ability and the opportunity to do this, and he could take both away if he wanted to, because he gave them both to me. And so, man, I hold this really loosely up here. But whenever they ask that to me, there's times I just want to go, "Hey, man, it's not as glamorous as you think." All right? It's just like, here's what it's like. All right? It's like spending 15 to 20 hours a week writing a research paper and then getting to know it well enough that you can stand up and orally deliver it to thousands of people, half of which aren't even in the room, so I can't tell if they like it or not. And I know that what I'm going to say, somebody probably won't like, agree with, or understand, and then I got to do it again next weekend. That's what it's like, all right? And I just realized that it's a heavy, heavy responsibility. Here's the thing. Some of you are like, "This is how you're reading verses 1 and 2. Well, I'm glad I'm not going into ministry, all right? And it's just like, wouldn't want to do that. I don't want to be judged more strictly. But I think that the same can be true for those of you, and I know that we have many in our church, that if you're a follower of Jesus, and I know that many of you, we have many gifted communicators in our church, and you do it for a living. And God has kind of put you in a position where when you speak, it has ripple effects, and it affects people. And I think the same thing is applicable to you. Man, use that gift, steward it wisely. It's easy for those of us who are good speakers to actually mask our character behind our ability to speak. Man, just don't do that. James goes on in verse 2, he says, "Hey man, if we could control our tongues, we would be perfect." So he's being facetious, all right? We won't literally be perfect. But he says, we could also control ourselves in every other way. And so I love how James kind of talks about the tongue as if it's like sort of a separate thing that has a mind of its own. I can't control my tongue. He's just like, he's just doing what he's going to do, right? And what James is kind of leading us into here is that really the tongue sort of sets the standard. The tongue directs all of our relationships and the very direction of our lives. And what he's going to do in verses 3 through 6 is he's going to actually teach using some metaphors, which I really appreciate. Actually, in the first century, Jewish teachers many times, when they were trying to communicate a point, they would use metaphors in sets of three to really try to drive their point home. And this is exactly what James does. He begins with the first metaphor in verse 3. He says, we can make a large horse go wherever we want by means of a small bit in his mouth. And those of you who've ever ridden a horse, like, you know this to be true. You are on this big, powerful animal, and you can control it. You can direct where it goes with just a small bit in its mouth. James says the tongue is like that for your life. And he goes, well, hey, maybe horseback riding isn't your thing. Maybe you like to go on a cruise. Well, I got a metaphor for that too, all right? Verse 4, he goes, and a small rudder makes a huge ship turn wherever the pilot chooses to go, even though the winds are strong. In the same way, the tongue is a small thing that makes grand speeches. And then here's metaphor 3, but a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire. And among all the parts of the body, the tongue is a flame of fire. It is a world of wickedness, corrupting your entire body. It can set your whole life on fire, for it is set on fire by hell itself. Wow. Those are strong words. And James, what he's doing is he's actually stretching the human language to its limits to try to help us to see that our words carry weight. Our words really matter. And when he says whole life, he's not only talking about every facet of your life, I think he's also talking about the duration of your life. And if you're just thinking, well, you know, just with age and experience, then I'll finally get to this place where my tongue will be managed. When he goes, no, man, if you're not intentional about this, you can let decade after decade, relationship after relationship burn to the ground. When are you going to learn your lesson? You got to get control of your tongue. Now, if the first two metaphors have to do with the direction of our lives, that last metaphor has to do with the potential destruction that our tongue can cause. And so James says in verse 7, people can tame all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and fish, but no one can tame the tongue. It is restless and evil, full of deadly poison. Sometimes it praises our Lord and Father, and sometimes it curses those who have been made in the image of God. And so blessing and cursing come pouring out of the same mouth. Surely, brothers and sisters, this is not right. Does a spring of water bubble up or bubble out with both fresh water and bitter water? Does a fig tree produce olives or grapevine produce figs? And he answers his own questions. No. And you can't draw fresh water from a salty spring. When I was in college, the pastor of my home church came over to our campus and did a dorm devo with us guys in our dorm floor. And we used to do this several times a week. And I don't remember very many devos or devotionals that we would do together as a dorm. But I remember this one. And it was this passage that he actually read to us. And after he got done reading it, he goes, hey guys, I want you to imagine there's like a water fountain in a room. And you're thirsty. And 9 times out of 10, when you walk up to that water fountain, you're going to get a mouthful of cool, refreshing water. But 1 time out of 10, it's going to produce salt water. He goes, let's just go worse than that. 1 time out of 10, it just produces like maybe sewer water. It's just something really vile. He goes, here's a question for you. How many experiences with that is it going to take for you to avoid that water fountain altogether? Even though 9 times out of 10, you get fresh water, if you just have one experience where you get a mouthful of bitter salt water, he goes, chances are you're just going to avoid the water fountain altogether. And he goes, and some of you, most of the time what you say is appropriate, most of the time what you say is right, most of the time what you say is kind and encouraging, but even just one time, you just haul off and tell somebody off and vile stuff comes out of your mouth, he goes, people will begin to avoid you, and those relationships, they just won't make it. See, James' teaching here applies to our relationships, but he turns a corner in verse 9, if you saw it, and he says, hey guys, I'm speaking to those Christ followers within the church, as he says, this is actually hindering and keeping people back from experiencing what Jesus has to offer to them. I'm reminded of what Jesus said to the woman at the well whenever she was struggling, and Jesus said to her, he's like, I want to give you water that you'll never thirst again, and we live in a world that is thirsty. We live in a world that is thirsting for what? They're thirsting for hope. They're thirsting for answers. They're thirsting for love. Trying to find it wherever they can find it and always keep coming up short. And Jesus says, I've got the water that will make them never thirst again. I want to give it to them. And here's the amazing thing about it is he says, I want to use you to do that. I want to use you to lead them to me. And so all it takes maybe is for somebody who's really thirsty and they say, well, maybe I've tried to find it everywhere else, but I can't find it. But I've been hearing some things about that church. So maybe I'll go to that church. Maybe I'll check it out. And what if they come and maybe they muster up the courage to be here? And then just one time, we didn't do it on purpose. We didn't do it intentionally, but we gave them a mouthful of salt water. That's the picture James is painting. And he says, brothers and sisters, man, this isn't right. They're actually rejecting Jesus because of the words that we've spoken to them. And I know people like that. I know people who said, man, yeah, I tried church and it didn't work. Or I went and some religious people said some really, really hurtful, hateful, nasty things to me. And so they rejected Jesus because of it. And Jesus says, no, I want to give them fresh water. And I want to use you to do it. And I'm really, really grateful for this church and what God is doing here. God is doing some amazing things in this church that we can't take credit for. And I don't fully even understand. I mean, so much of the time, my prayer is, God, just help me not to mess this thing up. I don't want to get in the way of what you're doing here. But I've begun to have people from around the country call me or email me or ask me, hey, what are you guys doing there? Like, why are you guys growing? Why are you guys so effective? And I have to tell them honestly, like, man, I really don't know. God's doing what he's doing, and I can't fully understand it. But I've been thinking about this a lot since I've been getting this question. And I think that one of the answers as to why God is doing some uncommon things in our church is because this church, for the most part, we still have some work to do. This is a church that watches its tongue. From the leadership meetings that I'm in, to the hallway conversations that I experience and see, to what I see out in the community, man, I get to work with some very talented men and women that are passionate and gifted and have differing opinions, and yet we know how to talk to each other in a way that is God-honoring and builds each other up. And I believe that God honors that. Now, that doesn't mean we're perfect. That doesn't mean we don't have some ways to grow in this area. We all do. But I think by and large, it's the church that watches its tongue. Because I've been in churches, some of you have as well, where gossip just swept through the church like a wildfire. Divisive, nasty, hateful, bitter words swept through the church like wildfire. And you just couldn't control it. And I think that there's a lot of churches that want to grow. I think there's a lot of churches that love Jesus just as much as we love Jesus. There's a lot of churches that they have vision, they know what to do. But man, if you don't control your tongue, I don't think God blesses that. Because God's like, why would I send you people if they're just going to get salt water? It's a warning for us. God can pull his hand of blessing back off of us if we don't control our tongue. So keeping in line with James' teaching pattern here in chapter 3, what are some specific ways that our tongue can become like a wildfire? What are some ways that our speech can actually be like salt water? I want to get real, real specific. And some of you might think, you might call this meddling, but I just call this good application, all right? And so you might pull out your cell phone, take a picture of some of these words. I want to name them, all right? Here's one way that our words can become a wildfire. This is probably pretty self-explanatory, but just harsh and mean-spirited words. You ever raise your voice at somebody, yell at them, scream at them, just tear them down, and you don't expect any sort of response? You don't want one. You just want to give them a piece of your mind. That's harsh and mean-spirited words. And there's just nothing salvageable about it. It'll burn the relationship to the ground faster than anything. When I was in college, I did an internship out on the West Coast, and we were staying with the family in the church, and I actually had a roommate. It was the family's nephew. He was there working a summer job, and he was about 6'5", very intimidating guy, and he had a temper on him. And I remember the first time I experienced it was maybe 2 weeks into the internship. We were home by ourselves, and I was on the phone with Lindsay. We were dating at the time, and he came in. He was upset about something, maybe a dish or something that I left in the kitchen. He came up and basically just laid into me, nose to nose, just tearing me up. And I remember just being shocked by it. Like, I remember thinking, it was so bad, I thought, I might need to move out. That's what I thought. Here's the thing. He did that like several more times that summer. Here's the thing. About 15 minutes later, after he would get done chewing me out, he would be totally fine, like cool as a cucumber. Anybody know anybody like that? And I'd walk into the room, he'd be totally, I'm like all defensive, like, dude, are you going to swing at me? You know, I'd walk into the room and he'd be like, hey, Brockett, you want to go to In-N-Out and get a burger? Like, no, I don't want to get a burger with you, dude. I would not eat a burger with you on a boat or with a goat. I would not eat a burger with you in a tree. I would not eat a double-double with you, you see. All right, I would just go all Dr. Seuss on him. He'd be like, whoa, tone it down there, bad boy, all right? What he was doing was he was throwing up all over me. Probably had nothing to do with me. It's probably something else. And he felt better, but I'm like covered in his salt water. See, here's the thing. Like, when we do that, it's because we want some sort of a result or a response. But see, flowers don't grow through the thunder. Flowers grow through rain. And so, man, if you're just trying to, like, just raise your voice because you want to get something done, it'll actually have the opposite effect that you intended. Another set of words is just bitter and cynical words. These are words that we use when we just sort of assume that everybody else's motives are impure and selfish. We don't understand what somebody else has said or done, so we just sort of write them off. Everybody else in this world is an idiot except for me, right? That's what we're communicating through bitter and cynical words. Another is sarcastic and condescending words. You know, sarcasm is when we use words at somebody else's expense. And we might say that we're kidding or joking around, but there's an element of truth in it, and it's enough to wound someone. And here's the thing about sarcasm is most people don't want to, like, rain on your parade or on your humor, so they'll kind of smile and laugh, but it's secretly on the inside they're wounded, and you don't know it. Now, I'm just kind of curious, how many of you have this, like me, you have the spiritual gift of sarcasm, all right? You're just very, very good at it, like all the time. You're like, ooh, that'd be really good. You're like, and you want to use it. And especially as a younger man, before I had really, like, grown up and matured, which is debatable if I really have now. But as a younger man, like, I was good at it, and so I would yield it all the time. And I just thought I was having a good time, and I was actually burning relationships to the ground, didn't even know it. Here's the thing that I would just say is that it's probably not even worth, well, it isn't worth the small little laugh that you might get if you use sarcasm. Another is passive-aggressive words. These are words that we use, or actually the lack of words we use. Sometimes this is just known as silent treatment, like giving the cold shoulder, and we've all done it before. Here's what it sounds like. It's like, hey, man, I think something's wrong. Is everything okay? Are you okay? Oh, yeah, everything's fine. No, it isn't, right? And so you kind of give the impression that everything's fine, and you actually need them to kind of keep prying. You want them to feel bad about what they have said or done. And man, we've all done it. I've done this. It's a form of manipulation and control that actually blocks further communication rather than going deeper into it. Another is untrue words, otherwise known as lying. Here's the thing about lying is that we all have been lied to, and we don't like it, and we have all lied before, and we know that it's wrong, so why do we do it? And I think the reason why we lie is very, very simple. Two reasons. We lie to promote ourselves and to protect ourselves. And so we lie whenever we're afraid that you're not going to notice like the good things that I've done, so I'm going to go ahead and promote myself and actually exaggerate the truth so that I come off looking better than I really am. Or maybe you get backed into a corner, and so you lie to protect yourself. And Proverbs chapter 12, verse 19 says, truthful words, man, they will stand the test of time, but lies are soon exposed. Another set of words is just corrosive and toxic words. These are words that and statements that we use that are just simply exaggerated, and they're definitive, and they put people into a box. This was actually on my social media feed when I just asked you what are some of the most hurtful things that people have said to you. Corrosive and toxic words was about 90% of it. Statements like, man, you'll never amount to anything. Statements like, you always do this. You just never get it right. Man, the words always and never are just always exaggerations. We'll go back and edit that out later, all right? So, why can't you be more like your brother or sister? You're a loser. I hate you. Man, those are just corrosive and toxic, and they will stay with somebody for life. Now, there's critical and complaining words. How many of you have an Eeyore or a Debbie Downer in your life? And you just can't share any kind of good info or a good news with them because they'll always spin it and turn it into a negative, and so something's always wrong, right? The weather's too cold, too hot, too humid, the prices are too high, the waiter's too slow, the food's too spicy, the music's too loud, the traffic's too congested, the church is too small, church is too big. Several years ago, the University of Denver conducted a study, and they found that one of the greatest predictors of divorce is when 10 or more negative or critical comments take place per 100 conversations. In other words, with your spouse, if out of every 100 conversations that you have with them, if 10 or more go negative, then that's one of the predictors that your marriage might be headed for a divorce. The same principle is actually true in the workplace. In a business book called The Carrot Principle, a 10-year study involving over 200,000 employees, one of the key findings that they discovered was that 79% of employees who quit their jobs cited the reason being a culture of criticism and a lack of encouragement. The last one that I'll mention is gossip and rumors. And gossip and rumors is maybe the most pervasive. It's maybe the most destructive in the sense that it's easy to disguise. Sometimes it's difficult to detect when somebody is gossiping or spreading a rumor. And especially now with social media, this is just rampant. You know, in the 1970s, some of you might remember this, the U.S. economy wasn't doing very well. And there was actually a shortage of three things. There was a shortage of gasoline, a shortage of onions, and a shortage of electricity. And so in 1973, somebody started a rumor that there was a shortage of something else. They started the rumor that the United States was on the brink of running out of toilet paper. And any of you remember this? And I think Johnny Carson maybe had something to do with this. He was a late-night talk show. And people just freaked out. And so they're running out, clearing out the stores of toilet paper. And a United States senator fueled that fear when he released this press statement that said the U.S. may face a serious shortage of toilet paper within a few months. A toilet paper shortage is no laughing matter. It is a problem that will potentially touch every American. No pun intended, all right? And it was a rumor. It was all gossip. It wasn't true. See, gossip and rumors are so destructive because they're easy to disguise, especially within the church. And so it's easy to disguise gossip. It's easy to gossip, and maybe you don't even know you're doing it. Because maybe it's a legitimate concern that you have. Maybe it's a conviction or a criticism. Oftentimes, unfortunately, here's how gossip starts in the church. It starts with a prayer request. And instead of just stating the prayer request, then we got to add our commentary to the prayer request after, and that's where we venture into gossip. Let me just provide this working definition of gossip. Gossip is saying something that may or may not be true. It could actually be true, but still gossip. It's true about someone, but they're not physically present, and we assume the worst about their intentions and their motives. In other words, there's a gap in information. Did you hear? They made this decision, and I don't understand it. Well, I heard, and then you start to go into it. There's a gap of information there that you don't have, and it's the least gracious explanation. So instead of going to the person, we just fill in the blank with suspicion on it. And so it's one thing to have gossip said about us. Like when we're gossiped about, like we're like, whoa, 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 that's wrong. It's easy to let slide, though, when it's about someone else. In Proverbs chapter 16, verse 28, it says, a troublemaker plants seeds of strife, and gossip separates the best of friends. In other words, even the strongest relationship cannot withstand the destructive forces of gossip. God feels so strongly about this that in Romans chapter 1, Paul is actually listing out all these horrible things that people can be guilty of. And he says, their lives became full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, quarreling, deception, malicious behavior, and gossip. And you're going, whoa, whoa, whoa. You remember that song on Sesame Street, one of these things doesn't belong with the others? They're like, I don't think gossip should be included in this paragraph, Paul. All these other things like murder and hate, those are really serious. Gossip's just fun, right? And he's like, no, it's not fun. God does not hate very many things, but he hates gossip, and he makes it very clear that he does. Why? Because of what it does to relationships and to communities. It just shreds them. It tears them apart. And here's the even further convicting thing. Gossip isn't just what you do with your mouth. You can also do it with your ears. When you listen to gossip, you're actually just as guilty of it as the person that is actually doing the gossiping. Now, here's the thing. If somebody is gossiping to you, they will gossip about you. And so you got to ask yourself at some point, man, do I have the courage to actually step up and to say something here? And I realize this, that many of you are non-confrontational. You hate confrontation. And so when somebody gossips, you think the best thing to do is just to sit there quietly. You don't agree with them. You're just letting them vent. But actually, what it is that you're potentially encouraging them to keep doing it. Maybe they interpret your silence as an endorsement. So what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do when you're in your group and all of a sudden the conversation turns into gossip? Well, you don't need to reprimand. You just need to redirect. And here's how you redirect. I have a friend who does this really, really well. When somebody starts gossiping, what they'll do is they will say one or two really encouraging things about the person being gossiped about, and then they will say, you know what, you ought to go directly to them and talk about the issue that you have. You know what happens to the gossip when they say that? It just shuts down. And the Bible actually tells us that this will be the result. In Proverbs chapter 26, verse 20, it says, fire goes out without wood, and quarrels disappear when gossip stops. See, here's the thing. There is so much power when God leads a person to say the right thing at the right time to somebody who is thirsty, to somebody who desperately needs to hear it. And I know for a fact, because I've heard from many of you, that there are a lot of you across all of our campuses where God led someone into your life to say something to you at just the right time, and it was something that you desperately needed to hear, and maybe that other person doesn't even fully realize how God used them in that moment. But it changed things for you. It gave you some hope. You turned a corner. And here's the thing is, I want to be that kind of person. I don't want to be the kind of person that my words were as a spark that caused a wildfire, and then just to go, well, I didn't mean it. I mean, it wasn't intentional. It wasn't on purpose. Well, at that point, does it really matter? My words became a wildfire that burned these relationships to the ground. I want my words to be more like a waterfall, just fresh water, building people up. That doesn't mean that I'm going to shrink back from stating the truth. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to offer constructive criticism. It doesn't mean that I don't have convictions. It means that every word that comes out of my tongue, I want it to be glorifying to God. And I want it to build others up. So how can we get to this place where maybe we can stop before we speak? I like this acrostic right here. Maybe some of you have seen this. It's not original with me, but it's just the acrostic think. Right, if your mom has ever said, hey, you need to think before you speak, right, this is it. And so before you say something, just run it through this grid. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? And is it kind? That'd be a pretty good discipline. Just to kind of stop, give yourself 30 seconds, run it through those questions, and before you actually speak. I love what David writes in Psalm chapter 139, verse 17. He says, how precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered. That shows you the very heart of God and what he has, his intentions for you. That when God thinks about you, his thoughts are precious about you. And if anybody had reason to actually be upset with us, don't you think it'd be God? And God says, no, I actually choose to think about you in the best possible way. I'm thinking precious thoughts about you, thoughts to reconcile with you, thoughts for your well-being and a purpose for your life. And if God can think precious thoughts about you and me, then we can start there in our relationships so that our words are like fresh water to those that we come into contact with. Let's pray together. Father, we come to you right now. And I know throughout this series that it's just been working so many of us over because this applies to all of us. Because we use words every day to communicate with those that we come into contact with. Relationships, they will either thrive or they will shrivel up and die, dependent upon our words and our conversations. God, our effectiveness as a church to lead people to the living water that will never make them thirst again in you is all connected to our speech. So God, we pray that you would help us to think. Help us to really weigh our words so that what comes out of our mouth would actually not only be glorifying to you, but it would actually build others up and lead them closer to you. In these next few moments, God, as we reflect on the teaching, as we ask you to now turn this to us, that we would make the decision, hey man, what is it that you want me to learn from this, to take away from this? What do you want me to do? I pray that your Spirit would meet us in this place as we reflect upon this teaching in these following moments together. We thank you for being a God that thinks precious thoughts about us. We ask this in Jesus' name.